Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Take a trip down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear as PSP rides again. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium with your hosts, Mike Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons.
Hola! Happy Cinco de Mayo. We are the, as Les Thatcher calls us, the law firm of Oates, Simmons, and Norris. But I'm telling you, if you get in trouble, don't call us, because if you do, somebody's going to jail. We'll probably get your life sentence for jaywalking.
More than likely.
Yeah. Oates, Simmons, and Norris doing business as Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe. Oh.
Is that kind of like the Three Stooges?
It would be real close.
So did you guys at least have Mexican food for lunch today for it being Cinco de Mayo?
Well, I really didn't.
No, I didn't either.
And besides it being Cinco de Mayo, I'd like to wish a happy birthday to Cowboy Bill Watts, who turned 72 today. And another great name, Canadian wrestler, Billy Two Rivers, who is 76 today. So we have them as well. And just want to, we got, somebody called me, they said they were going to be on the air with us, wanted to be on the air with us, and I thought he's already called in. Let me get him on the line real quick. It's Go Dickie Go time. How are you doing this evening, Mr. Steinborn?
Hi, guys. How y'all doing?
Good evening, sir.
What's going on?
Well, we was waiting for you to get started.
I was talking to Mike about that today. You know, I don't know what it is, but when you start talking and start telling a story and you're starting to remember what happened, then something else comes in, so you have to follow that up with after that story. And it's just like a roll. It rolls down the hill, and you keep picking up moss, you know.
Well, me and Jerry have really been worried about you, Dick. You know, we want you to come out of your shell. I mean, you know, you're kind of introverted.
I told this before. I used to read Reader's Digest every time I flew on the plane. I read from the front to the end. It's the most educated book there was. It was like going to college, and these educated people were teaching you. All you had to do was read it. Well, the guy went into a psychiatrist, and he told the psychiatrist, he says, I have a problem. The psychiatrist says, what's wrong? He says, well, you know, when I go to the movie, I like to sit way down on the lower left-hand side, and I like to stay in my room all the time, and I don't want to be around people or anything. And the psychiatrist says, well, you know, but the real problem is, consider a coconut. You're living inside of a coconut. You can't get out. It's just a little bit broader where you live, but that's in your mind. The fellow jumped up and ran to the door, and the doctor says, where are you going? He says, I got to go home and take care of my uncle. He says, why? He said, he's living in a walnut. And imagine this guy sitting there in a little, he can't move. Sitting on a couch someplace. I wanted to talk about one thing that you guys talked about last week in the movies. I tried to come in, but I guess you had so many people on there. You talked about Lenny Montana. I asked Lenny one time, I says, how did you get in that movie, The Godfather? He says he was in New York City. He lived at the Holland Hotel. And he says he was making this movie. And he says he went down there and he started watching him. He's standing on the street corner. Of course, he had a head. His head was higher than anybody else because he was like 6'4". And he says the director started looking at him. And he sent the courier over and he says, would you like to be in the movie? He says, yeah. He says, they put him in the movie. The other one was Terry Funk. Now, that movie he was in, Paradise Alley, a lot of people don't know this story, but I was in Puerto Rico in the dressing room, and Terry had flown down that Friday night. No, that's Saturday. He missed the TV. He flew down to Bayamon. He got in the ring. When he got through, I was in the dressing room. He came out of the shower, and he said, Dick, he says, I got to tell you something that went on. I said, what? He says, I was on an airplane, he says, and I was reading in Time, was either Time or Newsweek, that this director in California was making this movie, and he was calling it Paradise Alley back in the early 20s or something in Lower East New York. And he had two people in mind. One was Sylvester Stallone, and the other fellow was an actor, and they were looking for a third brother. So Terry says, and this is one thing that's always been great about Terry, he's innovative. Yeah, he just, I always admired him on that. So many things he's done. So he says, I decided to write the director a letter. Well, I don't recall the director's name. Let's call him Mr. Smith. So he writes Mr. Smith, and he says, Mr. Smith, he says, I'll have you know, he says, I'm one of the toughest guys in Texas. My father was the greatest wrestler, with king of the death matches, and my brother was a wrestler, and I'm a wrestler, and I think I'd be good for your movie. He says, I can talk on TV. Whatever he said. And the director got the letter and wrote him back and says, thank you very much for your concern. He says, but we're looking for a third brother that's an Italian. He says, and I understand you're not Italian. So he says, he said, Dick, he says, I had him. He says, he bit. He says, so I wrote him back. He says, I wrote him back. He says, well, he continued on. He says, like I said, my father was the king of the Texas Death. He repeated the same letter, and at the bottom he says, who's to say the mother didn't have a you-know-what in the woodpile? And he sent the letter back. And he says, the director read it, and he says, this guy's kind of, oh, by the way, at the end of the letter, he says, I'm wrestling at the Olympia in Los Angeles. Please come to the matches. Well, the director, he took Stallone down with him. They went down to the matches, and he said he brought him in the dressing room, and to the sister of the guys, Terry got him on a live interview, sitting right there at the table when Terry went in the ring. They went out and had drinks after a while. And Terry says, start giving him ideas and so forth. And they said, when we give you the script, will you rearrange it? He said, yeah. So Terry put himself as Frankie Thumper. And if you remember, at the end of the movie, he had a manager. And the manager was put into an embarrassing moment at the end, and it happened to me in Amarillo. Now, here's what happened in Amarillo. I'm in the corner with my partner against Dory Sr. and Ricky Romero. And my manager was Jack Kane, and he wore a suit. And before we went in the ring, they gigged his back pockets. You put your handkerchief in the back, you took a razor blade and sliced down one end and the other one, the third one and the fourth one. And in the melee, when the match was over, Ricky Romero dove through the air and he grabbed the two back pockets of Jack Kane in the ring and he fell. And they were supposed to split all the way down. They didn't. They came down about 10 or 12 inches and Jack fell on his butt. But Terry evidently convinced them that's what they should do in the movie, and that's exactly what they did. They dove at this guy, and he slid the pockets down in the movie. And what they did a better thing. They put garter belts on the guy. Like it was a female impersonator.
That sounds like Terry.
Yeah, man. That's funny. Did anybody ever hear about the match between Muhammad Ali and Inoki? Anybody know how that ended?
Well, I know you promoted that fight in Columbus, didn't you?
Pardon me?
You put that match on in Columbus.
No, Inoki, and remember the closed circuit TV?
Yeah, you did that in Columbus. Didn't you do that?
No, that was another one, Jerry. But anyway, if you remember the match, Muhammad Ali was standing in the ring, and when the bell rang, Inoki sat down on his butt and put his hands behind him, and he brought his feet up like a crab, and he started chasing Muhammad. Muhammad raising his hands. Get him up! Get him up! He chased him, and he started kicking on the inside of Muhammad's calf. You know, he was martial arts, and everything tough about that man was now coming in the ring. And he kept doing that, and finally, after about the sixth or seventh round, he chased Muhammad Ali up the top turnbuckle. And even the camera was shooting up, and he was hollering, look, he won't even get up and fight. Well, why do you think he was chased up that ring turnbuckle? When the match was over, 6 months later, Muhammad Ali wound up with phlebitis. swelling of the nerves in the legs and had problems with his legs, slowed him down from then on. Then he got into exhibitions. But anyway, we were told that he was going to go in the ring and he was going to knock him out. He was going to take care of Muhammad Ali. He was going to do whatever he wanted with him because he was capable of doing it. And let me jump ahead of my story. I went to Japan, and in a six-man tag team match, Bruno Sammartino, myself, and John Little Jonathan against Sakaguchi, Giant Baba, and a newcomer by the name of Antonio Inoki. Now, here was a judo guy. He got real big publicity in Japan. They turned him pro. Now he's in the ring, and I guess Sammartino heard about him, so he played a riddle with me. He says, "You start, Dick, and teach him a wrestling lesson." Well, I went out there, and poor kid, he didn't know what was going on. So I went behind him, waist locked him, took him up in the air, and down he went. By the time he hit his knees, his right elbow came back and nailed me right in the eye. Oh, almost knocked me out. Crawled like a rat over to the corner and tagged out. Wouldn't touch me again. But the Japanese office was so smart that they kept us apart until my last week when I wrestled him in the dome. Anyway, I knew he was tough. And then when I worked in Knoxville for the Fullers, I had to do some of the TV work, and I was in the control room one time, and they sent one of those tapes down where he was going to take on Muhammad Ali. Now, he's in the ring working out with these other Japanese guys, and he's elbowing these guys, and he's putting the jiu-jitsu stuff on these guys. And, I mean, it looked like amateur night. I says, oh, my goodness, what's going to happen to Muhammad Ali? When the match, just before the match went on, and it was a double main event. It was Japan first, and then they were going to Shea Stadium, and it was Andre the Giant against Chuck Wepner. And Chuck Wepner was in the mixed match. Chuck Wepner was a heavyweight boxer, about 280 pounds. He was a big guy. And he was toward the end of his career, but that was the first one. First one, we heard that 5 minutes before Muhammad Ali went into the ring with Inoki, the mafia came into the dressing room in Japan and told Inoki, do not put your hands on Muhammad Ali, and walked out. This is 5 minutes before he won the ring. That's why he was on his butt. That's why he could not do the damage he wanted to do. Now they switch right over to Shea Stadium. And Chuck Wepner had a manager. Now it's a ballpark. It's outdoor. The lights on the one thing. There's a tremendous crowd there. And Gorilla Monsoon was the manager of the Giant. The Giant must have weighed 480 pounds. And while they're standing over in the corner, the manager comes up there with his hat on. They didn't have any handles or anything. And he makes the motion, standing on the apron, to Wepner. He goes like, get him in a headlock. He gets his little hand there. And he says, he shows it to people. He thinks it's a show. To take the thumb and hit him in the eye. Like, that's what I want you to do. Well, no manager's ever going to tell a boxer to do that. And he did it so obvious in front of all those people that here is Andre looking at this and Monsoon on the apron watching this, and sure enough, the bell rings, and what do you think Wepner does? He comes out there, doesn't know how to hook up with anybody, and gets a side headlock, and just because he brings that thumb up in the air to like to show the people, and just about that time, just when that thumb came down, he was up in the air. Andre had him up like a baby, and he walked over to the top ropes, and he flung him. I didn't say throw. He flung him those 7 or 8 feet down to the grass. And those people in the first row had to move out of the way. I saw it on TV. And Bob Stone, he comes running around, and he gets close to the manager, and the manager's down on his knees trying to help his champion up. Monsoon grabs with his two fingers. His two fingers. He makes them knuckles, the first and the second one, and he reaches down, and he grabs one of the fingers of the manager, and he squeezes as hard as he can, and he twists as hard as he can, and he breaks his finger. And that was a show. A lot of people don't know that. But if you ever watch the film, you watch that Monsoon run around that corner. And you see the guy getting up, the manager getting up, shaking his hand and up and down like he got a bee stung on his knuckle. Interesting story.
I sat through that fiasco. I paid $15 or $20. They were running it in St. Pete at the Bayfront Center, the closed circuit of it.
Uh-huh.
They ran that the Wepner fight, Andre fight, and a match between Briscoe and Funk from Atlanta. And
oh, really?
That was by far the best part of it. Yeah, that was how it was all presented, closed
Everybody
circuit.
Was
they
saying
were, there were three. Yeah, but that was the longest drawn out thing. And it makes sense now with you saying that because Inoki could have easily have done something, but he never got up off his backside. All he did was scoot around like a saddle crab and kick.
How would you like to be in the dressing room just with all with adrenaline running through your whole body, and you know you're going to go out there and you're on closed circuit TV and you're going to make all this publicity and so forth, and the mafia comes in and says, "Don't put your hands on." What do you do?
He needed Pat O'Connor there, didn't he, Jerry?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, Dick.
Yeah.
Going back, and I don't remember the details, but I remember this has got to be 72, 73. Weren't you involved in a movie they filmed there in Harrelson in an old
yes.
truck stop or something?
Yeah. It was called Ann Gunkel was doing promoting, so she said, "Would you like to be in the movies?" I said, "Yes." It was myself and Rick Hunter, El Mongol, and when you drive from Columbus to Atlanta on an old road, halfway there's a little bar on the left hand side. It's just a cinder block put up, and it's homemade and so forth. So the filming company rented it, and it was the pilot film they were making for The Dukes of Hazzard. And it was called Moonrunners. And I met Robert Mitchum's son. He was in it. Spanky McFarlane. Spanky McFarlane was, she imitated the name of Spanky McFarlane from the Dead End Kids and she was in a band. She was in a band, that's what it was. She was Spanky McFarlane. And I was sitting at the bar, and Spanky comes around the bar and says something to me, and I got up and I patted her on the butt and burped, and she nailed me. The director said to me, he says, "What we'd like to do is hit you and let you go down." And I said, "Wait a minute." I says, and it was a round table in front of me. One of those, you put your ball, everybody sits around, and I says, "Can you take the top of that table and take it off?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "Well, screw it on one side." So they worked on it. They put bottles on it. And I practiced with the girl. I got in the back, and I said, "Now look." I said, "When you pull me back around," I said, "Spanky, when you throw that punch, don't you look in my eyes. You look at my neck." I said, "You continue to look at me." She must have pulled me back about 7 or 8 times. And each time she threw the punch a little bit harder, "Oh, this is easy." I said, that's the deal. Once you throw that fist, this is wherever that eye is, that's where that arrow's going. That's where the bullet's going. And that's where your fist has to go. So sure enough, we put the bottles on there. And when she hit me, I did a flip upside down. It's like somebody had my left arm. I flipped over and put that right leg on the left-hand side of the table. And the bottles went over the bar. Almost took off the mirror behind the bar. And I hit the ground, and she stood there, and Director Walden says, "Three cameras." He hollered over. Everybody froze. He says, "What a business." Nobody moved. There must have been 25 people in that little room. He pointed to one camera, and he said, "Did you got it?" He said, "Yeah." "Have you got it?" He said, "You got it." "Yes." "It's a take." And everybody started moving. I'll never forget this. I land on the floor. I'm looking up, and all these people are walking by. It was over. You had your big day. That was a big thing. You were left there on the damn dust on the floor. Oh, by the way, they made a movie here in Richmond too called "The Murder of Mary Fagan." Some Jewish guy from New York came down to Richmond in 1911 or 12. So had a factory here, and had these girls working for him, and one was raped and murdered in the basement and accused him. And they took him to a jail, and I think they cut his throat there. And they saved him from the jail and took him to the hospital, and the people got up on the raided the hospital back in 1912 or something, took him out and hung him. And it wasn't until 40 years later, in 2020, I think, the fellow who witnessed it said he wasn't the one, it was somebody else. So they wanted to make a movie of that. So I had nothing to do in Richmond, so I went down and signed up. So they gave me a job as a policeman, had to wear that old uniform. And the second one was, I was in the audience the first one. And they have these directors here. They says, "Would you like to work tomorrow?" And I said, "Sure." And I said, "What do you get paid?" He says, $35 a day. I said, "Okay." So when I go there, I see Jack Lemmon, Richard Jordan, and we're making the movie at the Capitol Building. And you talk about a beautiful White House right in the city of Richmond, Virginia, with all the trees around, and it's just gorgeous. And people have these old dresses on from that old time. And they brought down Kevin Spacey when it was one of his first movies. And another fellow, I forgot his name, but he's the one. Anyway, they put me in a policeman's uniform. And the director was George Stevens' son. And he's now standing up in the Capitol building with his back against the wall. And Mom, he's hugging me. And my back's against his chest, and I'm a policeman. And I have this billy club. And 3 feet to my left, the door opens up, and here comes Jack Lemmon, who's the governor in Georgia at that time, and his wife, and they walk by, Richard Jordan and this one woman. And from the audience, just to the front of me, about 15 feet, this guy comes running through the crowd with an old cabby cab on, and he's got this big club. And I'm supposed to run over there and block him, which I did. But I know this from a long time ago, that if you have a speaking part in there and you just say the right thing at the right time, they're not going to take it out. They're going to say it's good, and you get paid extra. And so I didn't say anything. I said, "What would the policeman do?" So I'm standing there, and when they says, "Action," and the door opens up, and then it comes out, and the guy comes running, and I come running across, and I take that billy club, just like you would like a from left to right, and I jam it into his throat. He grabs it, and I holler, "Arrest that man!" George Stevens Jr. come out. 2 minutes later, he says, "That's a take." Sure enough, they paid me $250 more just to speak. I got that from Ted Christie. Ted Christie. Ted Christie says he was when he was around Charlotte years ago. He says when he was in New York and he was wrestling up there, he says he had a theater guild pass. Which means they'll use him, like he goes, does a job in New York for some place. So they got him on this Alcoa Hour one night, and Helen Hayes was on. And he was standing in the background, like the cocktail people and so forth, and it was black and white in those days. And as everybody walked out, they said good night, and they shook her hand. He's not supposed to do that. He was right in front of her. They had rehearsals. He wasn't supposed to do this. So two people are supposed to shake a hand and say goodnight, and he was the third one. He shook her head. She looked surprised. They're alive. What could they do? And he says, goodnight. He got paid extra. I never forgot it.
Amazing.
Yeah. I'll tell you one thing I used to like to do in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rican fans, I can see why their favorite sport was chicken fighting. They love chicken fighting. And when they're out there, they're passing the money back and forth. When the two birds hit once or twice, they'll change the bet because they got these spikes, and maybe this one's a little bit tougher. The minute one of them spikes hits that blood and their blood starts to spill, they go crazy. And only two things are going to happen. Either they're going to let that chicken die, or they love that chicken, and they're going to concede, and they send a message to the owner, and he throws in the towel, and they save the chicken, and they heal him back up, and then they use it for mating or whatever. But that's their sport down there, and they're just crazy about cockfighting. I forgot my point.
That happens about, all the time. Don't worry about it.
Oh, the Puerto Rico. Oh. So I knew what they were like. So I go down there one time. You got to go down there for on Thursday to get on the TV, I think. Yeah, you get that. You fly in, and they wait for the you get on the TV. So I took some tape, and I put it all on my left ear. No, my right ear. I just taped the whole thing up. And it was so obvious. This white tape was ridiculous. So I come on the TV with Ricky Sanchez. He's a commentator, and he speaks in Spanish, and he talks to you. He says, "Well, Mr. Steinborn, welcome to Puerto Rico." And I looked at him and says, "Por favor," which means please. I must have said it six times. "Por favor. Por favor, don't touch my ear." I says, "The doctor says I shouldn't wrestle." And now he's translating, and he's really building it up. And I got this idea years ago when I was in the National Guard, and I was supposed to know the Ten Commandments of Order, the orders of whatever it was in the National Guard. And I didn't remember them. And I put the tape on my ear, and sure enough, when the lieutenant came in front of me, he stopped and he says, "What happened to your ear, son?" And I says, "Well, I heard it wrestling." "Oh, is that right?" Blah, 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 and he walked on. He never asked me the questions he's supposed to ask me. So I did the same thing in Puerto Rico. Now I get in the ring with Miguel Perez. And I look at him, and he looks at me, and he nails me. Before we have instructions, before anything, he hits me one time. And you never heard an explosion in your life. That whole outdoor ballpark just went crazy. I didn't stand there. I bailed out of that ring, hit the floor, ran up the aisle, fell a few times, jumped up and down, and just held my ear. And you should have seen the people at ringside standing and applauding. That's the drama. Oh, shoot.
It's amazing. Tell me,
say
white
something.
People do.
Ted used to do this thing, and he worked with Wayne Cowan so much that he had, you know, he always had to try to find something else to do that would be different. And I think he told me he got this idea from you. I would go out to get in the ring to referee, and I'd set a folding chair down, and I'd step up on the folding chair and get in the ring and just leave the chair there. And Ted would come out, and as he would step on the chair, he would push it out from under him and take a bump on the floor and wouldn't move. He'd just grab his back.
Really?
And then, of course, Cal would come out and demand me, make him get in the ring, and I'd get out, and, you know, it was like you'd touch him, and Ted would scream, "Oh, no, I can't move." And
yeah.
But I think he told me he got that idea from you, Dick, about the chair.
Well, I saw it years ago when the old-time wrestler Rue Wright, who came back into New York as Lou Kim and wrestled Anthony the Rocker in the Madison Square Garden, and in New Jersey, he fell out of the ring, and he went and got a chair, and it had a cushion in it. He stepped on the cushion. He wasn't supposed to do that. He was supposed to end the match, and he got his foot caught in it, and he could not get it out because they had a seat pushing on it. They counted him out. And I said, "Gee, that's fantastic." Now they realize that was a good ending. How do you think he lost to Rocket in Madison Square Garden? You know, it was a boxing ring. And they got the three ropes, and in between the three ropes, they got that little rope that comes to hooks them all together that it wouldn't split open. He got tangled in that with his foot hung upside down with his head to the floor. He got counted out. You see these things, and you remember them, and all of a sudden it fits. I mean, it's easy. And then you get some of these promoters, and they say, "I don't think so." And then some of them say yes, because they read what you've done or heard something. And in my deal in the business, what I loved about the wrestling business was I loved the business. And it was easy for me to go to a different territory or go someplace else. So I want to go. Be surprised. You can go anywhere you want to because you have a universal business that you can do with anybody and change it if you have to or adjust till you have to. You go to Germany and wrestle in Hanover, and it's two-minute rounds. Well, you got something going that's real good. All of a sudden, bing, you got to stop what you're doing. The guy gets over and sits on the bench or the stool, and you sit on the stool, and you go back out again. It's unbelievable. But the people buy it. There was one thing interesting about Germany. My dad told me it happened when he wrestled there years ago. back in the middle 20s or something. When they start the music, everybody comes out of that dressing room. All the bad guys and all the good guys. They come up the steps, and it's the music. Da-dun, bum, 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 bum. And it's all every arena. Now, the wrestlers get in the ring, and they put their back against the rope, and they're all facing each other. And the announcer gets up in the ring. No, he turns on the side, and he says, Madame and Heron, Madam and women and men, these will be the first match. And they call the first, and you step forward two or three steps, and your opponent steps forward, maybe from the other side, and you both look at each other and kind of bow, and then you step back. In the second match, same thing. Third match, same thing. Then you got your main event. Now, you may have 24 wrestlers there, and you only got 14 of them going to work that night. And the other ones have to sit around and watch the matches. And while I was over there, I looked at this guy, and he's got a bald head, and he's in the dressing room, and he's got a ponytail. He's Mr. Kung Fu. And who do you think it was? Ricky Starr. He went back to England, had a Broadway show with a couple of girls, and then some of the night spots he was in, and he winds up in Germany as Kung Fu, and he was terrific. He did all those moves and everything. He's a great wrestler.
Well,
real name, Bernard Herrmann. He was Mark Starr's brother. He went to the Stanislavski School of Method Acting in New York. Everything was a feeling. You had to feel this and feel that. And I saw him in Madison Square Garden when he come to get the instructions. Here he's got his ballet britches on, so short and funny. He's got ballet slippers on, and he's got hairy chest, short hair like Napoleon with a little curl in there. And as he comes to get instructions, he puts both hands out, and he lifts them up in the air about 2 feet above the head of the referee, and he points the nails down at him, and he comes up on his toes. Now he's standing there getting instructions. And fantastic moves that he did with ballet mixed in with it.
Yeah, he was something else. I tell you, he came in here in the mid-70s and worked here for 4 or 5 months. And the first time I'd ever seen him, of course, that was long before I ever got my hands on any tapes with him from back in the 50s and early 60s. But he could do stuff. The only other person I ever saw that was able to do some of the acrobatic moves that he did was Argentina, Zuma.
Zuma. Zuma was Jack Pfeffer's imitation of Rocca.
Exactly. Yeah.
Jack Pfeffer built him because he knew Rocca was getting all this this publicity with this television with the word Argentina. Well, he just capitalized on that and used him. But the best one, you know, the most unpredictable one that nobody really followed was Larry Shane. I mean, this guy could do so damn good. I've seen him. I guess he was showing off the first time I was with him. But when the referee turned his back, he was right behind the referee. He put his hands on the referee's shoulders, and he hoisted us over like we used to go over the garbage cans, put both hands on and scoot. He scooted, and of course the referee just ducked just a little bit, and he went down. And sometimes he drop-kicked the guy in the air, using the referee as a pole vault. Fantastic moves he had. He was just way ahead of his time. In fact, he had every one of his matches, he worked in Mexico. Every one of his matches were high spots. I mean, he had like 6 or 7 high spots. They finally told him in Texas, you slow down to 2 or 3 and that's it. Because the other boys were complaining, you couldn't. And yet he didn't draw that money after he won the title and lost it, but he still outworked everybody. Fantastic matches.
Yeah, he was. I became a big fan of his through videotape. Of course, he was killed in the early 60s in a car wreck, so I never got to see him live. But through the magic of videotape, I've become a very big Larry Shane fan. There's a spot that he does on one of the tapes that I have on video of him, and the guy that he's working with is a very young Gary Hart. before Jerry became a manager. He was doing jobs for Fred Kohler in Chicago.
Wow.
And but the spot is Shane jumps up on his shoulders like he's going to do a victory roll. They go over to the ropes. Shane bends forward. Of course, taking Hart with him, grabs the middle rope. They both go over the rope.
Oh,
and that
wow.
wasn't spectacular enough. Then Shane, still with it on Gary Hart's shoulders, pulls himself back up over the, does a backflip, back up over into the ring, still on Gary Hart's shoulders, and they land in the ring just like they went out. It's amazing. I've never seen anything like it in my life.
I'll be there. I can picture it. You know, you mentioned Gary Hart. When I was in Texas, Mark Lewin and I were partners, and so he made him our manager. And some of the trips we made, he would pick me up in Dallas, and we'd drive down to Houston, and we'd talk. And I asked him, how you get started? He says he was a fan in Chicago. And he says the Volkoffs, Nikolai Volkoff and Boris, and that would be Steve Gobb and Ivan Kamarov. They were coming out of the ring in Chicago, Rainbow or the Marigold, whatever it was. And just as they were coming down, the police were around and protecting them. And some guy came running up behind them and was going to hit Steve. And Gary was sitting about the third or fourth row up in this high school gym. And he saw that, and he says, I got up and I ran down. And he says, just before that guy hit Steve, he says, I pushed him. And Steve turned around, and they realized. And he says, Steve grabbed me. And the cops said, no, he just saved you. So he said, he grabbed me, and he took me in the dressing room with him. And Steve said to him, he says, why'd you do that? And Gary says, it just wasn't fair. He says, well, whatever you guys did, it was all right with me. He said, but this guy was coming up behind you. And Steve says, why don't you wait till the matches are over? And they talked to him, and he says, they brought him. Next week, they sat him at ringside. And I says, why did they do that? He says, because everybody saw what I did, but they just wanted to, it was starting something new. And I says, did they ever tell you anything about the business? He says, no. He said, but I saw enough to realize what they wanted me to do. He says, I was a street kid. I knew what they wanted.
That's cool.
I remember Luke Graham telling me the story that he took Dick Barkley. Before Dick got in the business, he took Dick Barkley with him somewhere. And he said, he told Dick, he said, if I get in trouble, he said, I'm going to motion for you and you come help me. And he said, they got into the match, and I don't remember who he said he was in the ring with, but he said the guy had him down. He was working him over pretty good. And so he hollered, Dick, come here. And he said, Barkley got up out of the seat from about the third row, and he said he walked down to the ring. And when he got down to the ring, Luke said he run his hands in Barkley's front pocket, and he come out and nailed the guy, and the guy went down and he pinned him 1-2-3. And he said he left the ring, and he said when he looked back, Barkley was fighting for his life trying to get out of the arena.
That's a good one there.
Hey, everybody, got to tell you one more. One of those trips from Dallas down to Houston, Dusty Rhodes in the car. Well, I never made a trip with Dusty Rhodes, but I knew him from Texas when I was at a bar and he came up and introduced himself. He's going to West Texas. So we're going down, and then this is the conversation. Gary says, what's happening, Dream? He calls him Dream. Dusty says, I tell you what. He says, you know what I did? And he says, what's that, Dream? He says, I was in New York. And he says, San Martino was drawn, and he says, I was starting to pick up, and I was drawn. He says, and so I went to Club 54. And he said, before I went to Club 54, he says, somebody got me in touch with the actor that overdosed. What was his name, Luke? Bertucci?
Belushi.
Belushi. And he says, he had a limb. He says, he had some guy with a limousine. He says, and it was a cab kind of limousine. He says, before he went into Club 54, he says, we drove around Central Park. And he said, the guy opened up the glove compartment, and he says, we got ourselves just right. And he said, Belushi says, Dream, you ain't got no guts if you don't come on, if we don't drive up in front of 54. And he's telling this to Gary Hart. And he says, what you sitting on top of the car? And James said, pull the car over. He's a couple blocks before they get to Club 54. Dusty climbs up on top of this limousine, lays down sideways with his hand up on his chest like he's taking one of these poses. He's got this little short shirt on. They pull up in front of 54, all the people there. They open them up, they let them in. And now Dusty says to Gary, he says, you know who I was with after a while? And he says, who? He says, Andy Warhol. And he says, this woman come over to me and says to me, she says, are you with Andy? And he says, yes, I'm with Andy. He said, well, let's go dance. And he said, we went dancing. He said, we got through. He says, here comes Liza Minnelli. And he said, the photographer was right there. And he says, here I'm in the middle. Andy Warhol's girlfriend is on one side. And he says, Minnelli's on the other side. And he says, it's in the newspaper. And he says, I'm up in Hartford. And he says, Arnold Skolin was taking care of the show. And he says, I went up to Arnold and says, when am I going to get my chance in the garden? And he says, well, when you get over. And he says, opened up the newspaper. And he says, hot. And he pointed to the picture. And he says, is that good enough? And this is what he told Gary in the car. And here I'm sitting back like a fan. I mean, I'm in awe. I mean, really, you know. Since I was a kid, I used to sit there and watch wrestling on an 11-inch screen. Live in the 6-story apartment building, Astoria, Queens. We were the only ones that had the TV because my dad made that much money to bring one home. Had our neighbors come by and watching it, and it was live wrestling. Gene Stanley and Buddy Rogers and Tony Martinelli and Gino Garibaldi before he went to California. And I watched all these matches and watched all the endings and the interviews and so on. And then go to the dressing room in Jamaica Ring and sit there with all the guys. Steve Stanley, I mean, Gene Stanley was a great guy, but he was 50. He would have sewing things. He would sew his trunks in the dressing room. He had a little rip in it and so forth. If he had something in his shirt, he would sew that up to it. I don't know if it was a phobia or something, but that's the way he lived his life in the dressing room.
What else is going on? Oh, I gotta tell a story that I don't know if I ever told you this, Dickie, or not, but Leo Garibaldi, who you really grew up with, I guess, in the business. I think y'all started about the same time, what, 17, 18?
Yeah.
I was in Texas. He brought me out there, and anyhow, I rode somewhere with him. He was telling me about you, and when Dickie first started, he said, "Now this is a credit to your ability and what you did and how good you really were." Leo said, I think it was in Baltimore or somewhere up in there. He said, "You know, Dickie would go out and watch those guys. You know, here's Dickie, 17, 18 years old, and the guys, you know, 30 or 35 years old, been in the business, you know, 20 years or whatever." And Leo said, Dickie would go out there and watch him. And he said, when they'd come back to the dressing room, Dickie would tell them what they did wrong. Leo says, you know, you just don't do that. But he said, the sad part about it, he was right. He said, that's how in tune you were as, you know, young, even a kid, you know, to what you should do, when you should do it. Leo said, I mean, you had to have Leo tell the story or something, but I mean, he said, and the sad part about it, Dickie was right.
I didn't realize you lived in Astoria. Did you ever run into Tony Bennett? That's where he was from.
Astoria?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I played softball. When I was 16 years of age, I was on a softball team in Astoria, Queens. We played at high school 126 yard. I left that yard, and I was walking up Steinway Street, and I heard this guy singing. And I never forgot this. I looked inside, and I loved music because I was playing violin at the time. I looked in there, and there's this guy standing there at 4:30, 5 o'clock Saturday afternoon, warming up to sing that nighttime. And I saw the name. I never forgot the name, Tony Benedetto. That was his real name. And then he came out in 1951 with Because of You. God, that was a great song. And then Cold Heart.
One of my favorite singers, yes.
Oh, yes.
Pretty much one of my favorite singers.
Yeah, but Tony, yeah.
Can't touch Frank Sinatra, but he's close.
Did I ever tell you about the softball game I booked in Roosevelt Stadium, New Jersey?
No.
No.
You're kidding. The magazine was covered. I love softball. So I used to play and played in Californian leagues, and I played in New Jersey leagues, and I played for Borough Motor Company, and I caught for them. And I got to Vince McMahon Sr., and I asked him, I says, could we book a softball game? He said, why? I said, well, I said, I have a sick child in the hospital, and I need to pay for some bills, and I'd appreciate if we could do it. He said, well, he'd like the publicity himself. So they advertised on Washington TV on Thursday night, any team that would like to get together and play the professional wrestlers. I heard that they had done this in Indianapolis, so I was now going to do it in New Jersey. So we booked Roosevelt Stadium. Bob Orton Sr. played, Tony Martinelli played, Buddy Rogers played, Roy Heffernan played, a bunch of other guys, Kangaroos, and we had 2,800 people, $1 apiece. That's all we charged. And the stadium was only $600 to let us have it. But one of the nice things was those. I was working a deal with Skull Murphy, so I was catching, and Skull was pitching. And he could pitch. He could not do a windmill, but he'd do a sidearm, one of those slingshot-type things, a little illegal. So just about when he's about the third or fourth inning, I went over to the announcer, and I said, would you make an announcement, please? He says, yes. I said, would you tell Skull Murphy to put his hat on, because I cannot distinguish between the ball and his head when the ball comes over home plate. And the guy made the announcements. And Murphy looked at me and said, what did you say? And he comes in from the pitcher's mound to me, and we go at it. The wrestlers run out there, and they break the thing up, and they pull us apart, and the cop tells us to get out of the stadium. So Vince McMahon brought it back to Washington. Forced them into it. A little excitement.
Make your own entertainment.
Yeah, see, yeah. Do it my way. I got that idea from
Mobile.
Pardon me?
I said, here in Mobile, in the 60s, they had, of course, most towns, you know, cities did, they had a local program. That was a bit long before the days of cable. But there was a local cooking show that was taped in the same studio that they taped the wrestling matches in. And Mario Galento and Billy Hines, they did a thing where Mario was a guest on this cooking show, and Billy Hines charged, and they tore up that whole set fighting. And then they had a match between them the next night in Mobile and sold the place out.
Listen, you're from Mobile. Who's the guy, who's the wrestler that Buddy Fuller took this wrestler and had him open up a restaurant, a small little corner, a small place restaurant in Mobile 30, 35 years ago, 40 years ago. You don't recall?
Before my time, I don't know. I don't know if anybody, Bill Bowman would know, but I'll have to ask him about it.
I think he was a referee. And the word, when I got to the South and heard all these different, what Fuller told this wrestler who lived there, I think he fronted it. So he put the down deposit and so forth, and it was the kitchen. Because what Buddy wanted to do was send a couple of wrestlers in there one night and tear the place up and get the publicity, put the guys in the jail, and start from there. And the word I got was the guy who was running the restaurant tried to convince Buddy not to do it. And Buddy says, why? He says, because I'm doing too good a business with the restaurant.
I know Bowman will know. I have to ask him.
Yeah.
About that. You know, Don Carson and Billy Hines did the same thing in Columbus. They tore up some restaurant.
The Capri restaurant.
Oh, yeah, I remember where it was. I remember where it was. It's on the corner.
Yeah, they should. Oh, that got over like, oh, man. They hold them all, put them in jail. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Really?
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
Well, what else is new? I know I've told Mike and Jerry this story, Dick, but you're talking about Dusty. We did a deal in Atlanta where the premise was that Ole and Koloff had jumped him on the side of the road. So we were at the matches in Atlanta, and they make the announcement at the beginning of the show that, you know, Dusty hadn't showed up yet. If you want your money back, go to the box office. First intermission, Dusty hadn't showed up. We don't know what's happened, you know. The whole thing goes on. Well, the deal is I picked him up at the airport at 9:15, and we come back, and we're sitting in a parking lot across the street from the auditorium. And the deal is he's supposed to hit the door at 10 after 10 and hit the ring and Katie bar the door. So me and him sitting in the parking lot out there, it's about 10 o'clock, and it's dark. And he says, help me get ready. And I said, well, okay. So we're standing out there behind my car, and I'm cutting his shirt, and I'm ripping on his shirt, and we cut his pants. And he decides to get a little color, and he gets that. And he says, he says, what do you think? I said, well, okay, you look all right. We're good. I said, you got about 5 minutes. So there was a mud puddle on the front of the up edge of the parking lot. He said, I think I'll go roll in that mud. And I said, well, all right. So he goes up there, and he's rolling in this mud. So he gets up, and we're standing there looking at him, and we're talking. He says, what do you think? I said, well, it looks okay. Well, we hear some people laughing, and we look around, and we can't. And the city of Atlanta, the headquarters for the city of Atlanta Fire Department, used to be right there across the street from the auditorium. And we looked out, and on the balcony of the back of this fire department, there's about 6 firemen out there, and they've watched us do the whole thing.
Can you imagine yourself being the fireman looking down at it? What the hell is he rolling in the mud for?
Dick, how did the whole thing come about where you replaced Tim Woods as Mr. Wrestling?
Tim was married to a woman nicknamed the Tiger, and she kind of controlled him. And Ray told me, he says they made him on television. And what made Tim Woods as Mr. Wrestling was for him not to say, I'm going to do this on Friday night. He would say, under the mask, Mr. Wrestling's going to do this. Mr. Wrestling will not put up with this. Well, that was the most fascinating thing I ever heard. This guy was talking about the third party, and it was him underneath the mask.
Exactly.
If we look at it that way, he's talking about somebody else in your mind. It's a ghost or whatever. Anyway, so he was selling out. He was doing so damn good. Of course, he had Leo. Leo was doing the booking, and that was the whole thing. So he comes into the office, and he tells Gunkel on a Monday morning, I want a bigger percentage. And Ray said, what are you talking about? He says, I want 8%. Ray looked over at Leo and said, Leo. He says, yes. He says, take him off the books in 2 weeks. That quick. It was over. So he wrestles. Excuse me. So he wrestles the rest of the week. And then I think it left in 1 week.
No, Dickie. He run him off then. He was booked with Kaninsky.
No, I worked for Kaninsky. Kaninsky in Savannah. And what
that's
happened?
Right.
He filled his week up. I think he came in on a Tuesday morning. That was what it was. He must have given us a notice on a Tuesday. So that Tuesday for the next Tuesday is 1 week. So the next Tuesday would be 2 weeks. He didn't make those last two, Monday and Tuesday.
That's right.
And so he left on the Saturday or something. So Leo calls me and he says, can you remember take them 10 Woods? I said, yes. Because I watched him and I know what he could do. And all you could do is watch it and do it. If you're in shape, if you're limber enough. I used to imitate Ganya in front of him. He said, very funny. But anyway, so I knew what to do. So he orders the mask and the shoes and so forth. I flew into Atlanta and got in a cab. And I had that mask in my pocket. Just before I got out of the cab at the auditorium, they were 4 deep trying to get in that place. And it was against the pro, Doug Gilbert. And I went in the ring and finished that match. No, wait a minute. It was a guest. I'm sorry. Let's start all over. That was another time I came into Atlanta with Mr. Wrestling. So I go into Augusta, and I go in the ring with Hans Schmidt. And Mr. Wrestling wins. And we go to... After the matches, I get my mask on. Leo says, we're going over to the American Legion. So Monday night, after the matches, we drive over to the American Legion. While I got in the ring that Monday night, I didn't know how to walk to the ring, so I ran to the ring. So when I jumped over the rope like he did, and I did a little walk and strut, I went over to the corner and sat down on the second turnbuckle. I sat there. And I'm looking around through that mask at all the crowd, and everybody's looking around, talking to everybody. It's over. It's getting over. And Leo comes over to me. He's refereeing. He leans forward. He says, there's one person behind me that doesn't believe it. And he walks away. And I look over there, and there's this female staring at me. And she's the only one that's shaking her head no. Of the whole crowd. Like being in one of those tennis matches, and everybody looks to the left when the ball hits and to the right when the ball hits, and one guy sits in the middle and doesn't move his head. She was just the opposite. She was the only one who was shaking her head no, and everybody's smiling. So after the matches, I said, what do we do? He said, keep the mask on. He said, we go to the... I thought he was ribbing me. I said, he said, Dick, he says, he walks the streets in Savannah with the mask on. I said, well, okay with me. So we go to the American Legion that night. And... we're sitting there, we're having a New York strip steak, and this female comes in, and she sits at another table. And when I get to eating, and Leo was almost through, this female comes up, and she plops herself down right in front of me in the chair. And she looks at me, and she says, you're not Tim Woods. And I looked at her, and I says, you mean to tell me that Tim never told you that I'm 6 minutes older than he is? I knew it. She says, you're a twin. You're his twin brother. I knew it. I knew it. The God's honest truth. I went to Savannah. I swear to God, I walked the streets with that mask on. And he got in the ring with Kaninsky that night. I told Kaninsky, I says, I've worked with 12 world champions, and I consider you second best. He says, why aren't I first? I says, too many of the other champions might get jealous. That was always my favorite line. I used to tell that to Pat O'Connor. Pat, you're the best. You're the second best I've ever seen. He said, why not? I was like, who's first? I got to get jealous. Anyway, that was Mr. Tim Woods, Mr. Wrestling. Then I went back up there against Doug Gilbert. Then they wanted to end it. I went into Memphis as Mr. Wrestling, and tried to tell Jerry, I said, look, why don't you bring Tim over here? We'll go mask for mask and a whole bit. And he switched over to Boogeyman. What was his name?
Jimmy Valiant.
Valiant, yeah. It would have been a mask against mask, and Jerry wasn't involved. He was with Dundee all the time.
That was
one time.
You were.
Beg your pardon?
I was going to say you were Mr. Wrestling here too for a couple of months.
Yeah.
In when was 68, 69, something like
that. Yeah,
maybe
I don't know.
Panama City.
Yeah. I told you the funny thing about Charlie Smith, didn't I?
Yeah.
About him breaking up in a ring.
You got to no. Wait a minute now. You mean to say Charlie Smith actually broke up in the ring?
Are you kidding? Did I ever tell you the three stories about Charlie Smith breaking up in the ring?
No, let's hear it.
I was in Athens, Georgia, and I was wrestling Rocket Monroe. And Rocket used to love to do a high spot where you hit off the ropes, and you have him in a hammerlock, take him down, work around, all of a sudden he'd run. And he'd run and hit you with a tackle. And then you sidestep and you catch that left arm and you got to grab it right, left hand underneath the left shoulder, armpit, and grab that right hand and hold him tight. And he lifts himself up in the air and he flies. And all you got to do is guide him around, pull him back down, boom, he lands on his stomach. Charlie Smith's the referee. And Rocket says, oh, God, I think I just crapped my britches. And while I had this hammerlock, I lean back with my nose close to his trunks. Make believe I'm smelling his trunks, And I leaned back up, and as I had the hemlock, I said, "No, I think you just broke wind." And when I looked up, Charlie Smith is on his hands and knees. He's put his fist down, and his, wait a minute, his forehead is down on the mat, and he's shaking. And I don't know where I come up with these one-liners. And Rocket says, "What's wrong with him?" I says, "He's looking for his contact lenses." This is all while I got this hammer. Charlie rears up with those bright, big white teeth. He reminds me of a guy that's shooting an arrow, bow and arrow. One arm goes forward, the other goes back. He's not saying anything, right? So that was the first time. The second time, it's an outdoor show in Panama City. And I'm in the ring, ironically enough, with Rocket Monroe again. And it happened to be the night that Armstrong walked on the moon. And up in the air is this beautiful, white, perfect circle moon. And referee Charlie Smith is in the ring. I'm laying down. Rocket's got a standing wrist lock on me on his knees. And I'm looking up straight at that moon. And Charlie's right there. And I just move around behind his head so I can see the whole circumference of the moon. And I hollered at Charlie, "I see him, Charlie, I see him." And Charlie ducked like somebody was coming in the ring. And as he turned around, there was nobody there. And I turned back and I said, "It's Armstrong. He's walking on the moon. I can see him." And I swear to God, he dropped to his knees. He's shaking. His head hit the mat and come back up, and he pulled a bow and arrow on me again. So the next time, I'm going to the hospital in Atlanta. The assassin throws me over the top rope. I hit the floor. They count me out, call an ambulance. And ironically enough, that night, Ray Candy, who was a fan, was up in the balcony. He came down out of the balcony and got up in the ring and stood up in the ring looking at me down on the mat, on the floor, the wet floor. And he even moved his body over to shade the light from behind his back because it was in my eyes. He told me this 2 years later in Puerto Rico. So I'm laying on the floor and all this beer stuff and peanuts and everything else. And Charlie's next to me. And I says, Charlie. And he comes over and leans over and I says, and I remember watching a movie with Marlon Brando, Mutant on the Balcony, and he was dying laying in the surf, and he gave this death sentence. I said, "Charlie, give my Halliburton to Jerry Oates." Give my jockstrap to Ted. If he couldn't take it. Charlie, I swear to God, his head went down on the... He forgot he was out, not in the ring. He was on the floor. He hit the floor, and he come up. He had a little dirt mark in the middle of his leg. He was moving. That was the three times it broke.
Charlie promoted Cumming, Georgia, one night, and he asked me if I'd come wrestle. I told him, sure. So I went up under a hood, and he had me wrestling Ted Allen. And Junior Samples, the guy from Hee Haw, was sitting on the front row.
No.
And Junior Samples, what you saw on Hee Haw was Junior Samples. That wasn't that was him. And we're sitting on the front row. I mean, we worked in the match along, you know. And finally something happened, and I was over in the corner, and that Junior Samples got up and he went in his pocket like he's going to get a knife. And Charlie came over there, and he pushed me back, and they're talking, and yeah, yeah, yeah. And I looked at Charlie, and I said, "Listen." I said, "There's probably 10 million comedians out of work, just like that guy sitting right there on the front row." And I said, "You up here trying to be funny." And that's when the bow and arrow came out on me. He was gritting his teeth. And I'm watching Junior Samples out on the front row. And, I mean, he's getting up trying to come toward the ring. I told Charlie, I said, "Don't you let that man get in here on me."
That Ted Oates used to imitate him and say, you're not. Every time you talk to Charlie, he'd say, "How you doing? You know what? It's like some of the guys nowadays say, "You know what I mean?" Nowadays, everybody says, You know what I mean? And it's a habit. But Charlie says, "You know what?" Like, you know it. You know what?
Well, he'll call in a minute. He's got a hearing aid now. So I just spent a week with him in Vegas at Cauliflower Alley. We shared a room out there. And I'd be talking to him, and he'd go, "What? What?" And I'd say, "Man, is the hearing aid not working?" He'd go, "I ain't got it in. It's laying here on the table. It bothers me." And then he'd put it in, and I caught him, he'd put it in, and I'd catch him turning it down. I told him, I said, "We'll never come out here again." And he went, "Why?" I said, "Because you're going to actually hear what people say about you on this trip, and you're not going to want to come back anymore."
What you got to do when you put the hearing aid in is talk like you whisper, you're talking like real like words, but nothing coming out of your mouth.
Yeah. Oh, we've already got several ribs. We're gonna do that one on him, and then we're gonna have somebody sit in the room and hum. And I told somebody I was going to talk to him like Johnny Mathis sings. I was going to deaden every other word. But oh, what will we do without Charlie?
Dick, you tell them the it's kind of a tragic thing, but the last time you was in the ring with UConn Eric.
Oh.
His real name was Eric Holmback, H-O-L-M-B-A-C-K. I met him in New York. He had a 64-inch chest. I was like 14 years of age. He got in that ring with a long black robe on, and when he opened, he just undid it and let it open on its own. He tore the chest out, and the robe would slowly open, the satin robe, and this tremendous chest would come out. So he was a big star and got on TV out of New York and so forth. And unfortunately, his wife had left him, drained his bank account of $55,000, and took his two children with him. And he couldn't find them. Now, you would have thought somebody like he would have hired the FBI or a private investigator or something. But what little bit I knew of him, his personality was not like that. He would just rather sulk about it and, you know, don't worry about it. It'll work out itself and so forth. So he, we go to, he's in Florida, and it's a tag match between he and I against the Assassins in Tampa. And the match was over, and I drove back to, I got pictures of the last match. I drove back to Orlando. He went down to, he was booked at Fort Lauderdale. He was off on Wednesday and supposed to be in Lauderdale on Thursday. He didn't show on Thursday, but he had left that Tuesday night at the Tampa and drove to Cummings, Georgia. And he checked into a motel, and they said that he had drove out and then he drove back in like he would 15 feet out from his room and then 15 back again. And he was changing his mind, and because he was so obvious how big he was in that big convertible Cadillac he had. So he drove to a little church, and ironically enough, it was the church he was married in years before. And it was one of those rural churches, you know, red clay dirt around it, grass and wooden church and so forth. I think she was a local girl or something. And he took a pistol and he just put it into his mouth and he blew his brains out. Fell forward on the horn, and the horn started the long noise until the battery ran down. So that was like 45 minutes or 50 minutes or something, or close to that. And then finally they didn't want to go over there because he was this big hulk of a guy. You don't know what he's doing. He's crazy. Just a few farmers around there. So they found a note in the motel where he complained about the children and he wanted to end it all. But that was the last match I had with him. He's the last match he had. That was his partner. Huh. Nice guy, easy to work with. He was like a Haystack Calhoun. I mean, they can only work such a way, and then you have to work around it. So,
like Jerry's two favorite, the McGuire twins.
Yeah.
You know how one of them died?
No idea.
You're kidding?
No.
You know they got in these motorcycles. They told, and I asked, I sat in the dressing room, and I says, "Tell me about you guys." I'm putting a nice up shot. Still have pictures of them. And they, I had that little program, so I was writing on. He told me, he says, he wears out a pair of shoes a week. The soles are gone. And the motorcycle company, they loved motorcycles when they were kids. So they got them to sponsor them. So they revved up the motors to where they used to jump vehicles like Evel Knievel. And in Toronto, Canada, I think it was Toronto. I got the clipping here somewhere. He tried to jump 14 trucks, 14 cars or something. I see Benny and what was the other one?
Billy.
I think it was.
Yeah.
Billy and Benny.
Yeah, he went off the ramp in this outdoor stadium and didn't make it. The motor gave out or something, and he crashed and killed himself. Can you imagine the guy on a motorcycle?
No.
Well, that motorcycle would be revved up. It must have been cars. That would have been too long for trucks. Must have been cars, 9 or 10 cars. But to see a 400, 500-pound guy or 600-pound guy, I bet 700-pound guy on a motorcycle jump these things, I'd go pay to see it, too.
Yeah.
No, Jerry, you talked about me booking that closed-circuit TV in Columbus. No, that was Muhammad Ali and George Foreman in Zaire, South Africa.
Okay, I knew you did one of them.
I had the wrestling office there, and they sent me the publicity. I had a closed-circuit TV on. They sent me the publicity down. I didn't follow boxing that much in those years. They sent me the publicity down on Muhammad Ali, and they sent me the publicity down on George Foreman. Do you know that George Foreman only went one time a 10-round match with Dub Jones, and the rest of them were all knockouts? He never went past the fifth or sixth round. So I said to myself, holy, Muhammad's in shape. And here I'm a wrestler, and the boxing promoter from Columbus, Georgia, ran some spot shows. He came into my office, and he says, Foreman's going to win. I said, wait a minute, look, he's not in shape. He's not going to be in shape. And sure enough, he got the rope to dope. That's exactly what he did. He backed up, and George Foreman blew up.
Yep.
Blew up. I'll tell you about George Foreman. When my dad was promoting Orlando, Florida, they rented our ring to have professional boxing in the sports stadium. And I was a photographer, had my own black and white dark room, promoted my own program for my dad called Milo's Mat. And I have these negatives in color. I was the only guy around ringside when George Foreman came out of the Olympics, and he went in the ring with those headgears on. And it was an exhibition bout with, from Houston, Texas, got shot by a cop. I forgot his name. And while they were, and I was shooting these pictures, I still got the negatives. And while I was shooting these pictures, I watched in the match, and I see where George is, Olympic, right? And this veteran he's up against. I saw the veteran go to throw a left hook. He would have nailed Muhammad so easy, and he pulled the punch. He pulled it back. What is his name? I went to Houston sometime, some years later, and he was a good friend of Paul Bosch, and he came in the dressing room one night. I didn't think his name. And I went up to him, and I says, you know, I saw you the night that you wrestled. You fought Muhammad Ali. I says, George Foreman, when he came out of the Olympics. I says, and I saw you when you went to throw a left hook to the stomach. I said, you pulled that punch. And he looked at me and he says, that's business, young man.
No kidding.
That's what he said. That's business, young man. Oh, he would have nailed him. I'll think of his name in a minute. He had a funny kind of name anyway. He was sitting behind the wheel of a car and he got in an argument with a cop. The cop shot him into his career. Shot him across the chest. About that. The wrestlers, yeah. I saw Buddy Rogers go in the ring with Jersey Joe Walcott in Baltimore, Maryland. Did I tell you that one? I saw where he got him in a one-legged crab in the second round. He put that knuckle between those two muscles of the calf with that one-legged crab, and he put it, and Walcott with his gloves on was beating him out, saying, I give. And I heard, I'm back in the dressing room. I heard Buddy holler, I can't hear you. Fred Ward says, we got a wrestler coming in, wants to box one of the wrestlers in Columbus, Georgia. He says, who wants to take him on? He come in there dressing with that pencil. He banged that pencil on the table. You know, who wants to take him on? I said, I'll take him on. Who is he? I forgot his name. So he brings. We booked a show in Columbus, Georgia. The guy's got gloves on, and I'm messed. So I put the knee pads on. I did the same thing as Buddy Rogers did. They rang the bell. I flopped down on my belly. I got up on one knee and one hand, and I started crawling like a crab. He came close. I snatched his foot, got him on the one-legged crab, turned him over, and it was over in about 20 or 30 seconds. It was over. shoot. I'll tell you one thing that happened to me in Texas was embarrassing. I'm in the ring. Art Nelson is my partner. We're getting against Danny Miller and Jerry Kozak. And some guy hollered at me in the ring or something, and it just got rubbed me the wrong way. And it was one of those bull stadiums. Sell the bulls and so forth, and sawdust on the ground, and just maybe four rows around the ring, and then there was all cement balcony, and it was a closed enclosure. I bailed out of the ring, and I walked right up to this kid. He must have been 19 years of age. I said, what did you say? He said, I think you're this. And I, before I could tell it, the guy next to him left hooked me. Knocked me out. I'm flat on my floor. Big time wrestler, knocked out. Oh, Nelson comes over, he gets me up, he says, he's a teenager, leave him alone. We got back in the ring, God, he broke my tooth. He broke my tooth, had a gold tooth, and split the tooth. Man, it was hot. Well, evidently, he got the reputation. And the next week, they had a stage there with seats on the stage. He's sitting on the stage. And when I came out there, he stood up. Well, I came out and he waved at everybody, and I swear to you, half the crowd got up and applauded him. And it was in Abilene, Texas. So I learned this a long time ago too. So I just looked. I stood on the apron, looked at him, and I smiled and looked at the people, and I got in the ring, and I sat on the second rope, and I put my hand on the top rope, and I pushed it up, and I said, "Come on in. Come on." Looked at the people, and they all edged him. So he comes across the stage, down the steps, and says, come on, come on, come on in, come on in. He comes up the steps, and he stands. I said, wipe your feet. I'm sitting on the inside of the ring with my hand pushed him between the second and third rope, sitting on it, and he's over there wiping his feet. The minute he stepped through that rope, I stepped back. I field-goaled his face. Busted his nose, blood all over everywhere. He fell down on the apron and back onto the floor, and his buddies come off that ring. And I sat on the rope. I said, come on, who's next? And Danny Miller was coming around, said, and Cox was on the stage too, Killer Carl Cox. He said, you almost had a riot. I said, I wish we would have. You know, they're not supposed to come in the ring, but when I invite them in, I had to do something, because otherwise this kid would have gone all from then on. Wrestlers would have lost their respect. I had to put the respect back. He sucker punched me, and now I sucker kicked him. Like the Sopranos.
Well, speaking of suckers, we got, let me see if I can get him on the line with us. Mr. Smith.
Well, yeah, I'll do it.
We're talking about the night Dick Steinborn told you that he could see Neil Armstrong walking on the moon in Panama City.
Yes, sirree. How you doing, Mr. Steinborn?
Good, Charlie. Good to hear from you. Tell us something, Charlie. Tell us a story, Mark. Charlie.
Oh, I don't know a story. I'm listening to you.
Do you have your hearing aid in, sir?
Bobby and Jerry know something.
Do what?
Bobby and Jerry don't know something.
Oh.
Do you have your hearing aid in, Mr. Smith?
No, I don't, sir.
It's hard to tell stories when Dickie's on the line.
Oh, well, I tell it.
Yes, sir.
All you do, guys, is remind me of something else.
I know
well,
we told.
Let me ask all four of you. Well, Charlie, you'll have to get into the second part of this, but who's the, it's a two-part question to Dick, Jerry, and Bobby.
who is the best person that you ever worked with in the ring, and who was the worst?
Let Dickie go first.
I'd have to say five of them. The one that comes to mind real quick was Dory Jr. You can adjust to him real good. Go ahead, somebody else. Dory Jr.
That was your best? Yeah. What about worst?
How about your worst? Who's the worst you
Tony
ever had,
Nero.
Sanborn?
Tony Nero.
Tony Nero.
Tony Nero.
That's very good.
Oh, jeez.
Well, hey, I agree with Dickie on Junior.
He was smooth.
And then on Junior, he was always good to work with, you know it?
Yeah.
And the worst I had was Frank Morrell.
Oh, jeez.
Dickie, I don't know if you ever had the pleasure of this guy. The worst I ever had was Moose Cholok.
Oh, yes. I worked with him. He was bad back then.
You should have got a hold of him when I got a hold of him.
let me tell both of you, we harken back to a guy that we were talking about earlier, Larry Shane. There's a match out there, and it's on YouTube, on the internet. Do whatever you can to find that match. There's a match that I've got on video from the Marigold in Chicago, probably 61, something like that. It's Larry Shane against Moose Cholok. And I've told everybody that I know that is aspiring to be a professional wrestler or is training somebody to be a professional, find this match and watch it. It is textbook as to how to work a spot guy like Larry Shane against a big guy like Moose Cholok. It is, both of them are dead on perfect. It's the best I've ever seen Moose Cholok ever work, because I've heard horror stories about him.
Yeah.
He was Locke Baker and Tex McKenzie rolled together from what I understand, but he was a legitimate wrestler. He had an amateur background. But, and what's so rare about it is this was, I guess, I don't know if the Dumont Network was still in business in the early 60s, but it was a television show, and Larry Shane gets color in it. But it is a 2 out of 3 falls, and Larry Shane, the way he sells and everything, it makes Ricky Morton look like, you know, a stick, the way he's selling it, how good it is. But do yourself a favor and find that match and watch it.
Yeah.
Bobby, you hadn't said who's yours yet.
Well, wait a minute. We're not through. Jerry, who was your best? Cholok was your worst.
That's really, I'll tell you who I had. God, there's so many. But I'll tell you who I had some of my best single matches with. And I'm sure, Dickie, you wrestled him many, many times. It was Carl Cox.
Killer Carl?
Yeah.
Never worked with him. You're kidding me. No. I went to Texas as a heel. He was my partner.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. That guy.
I've seen him.
And Carl, he didn't get the credit he should have gotten. But I only wrestled Junior twice, and that was a pleasure. I mean, that was. But I guess I had so many matches with Harley, I really enjoyed wrestling him. I mean, he was. I guess we're not supposed to use that word wrestling anymore, right?
Oh, yeah, you can on my show.
Oh, okay.
This is basically a sports entertainment free zone here.
I'll tell you something.
In fact, I'll
one.
Find you if you say sports entertainment.
Right. Right, that's what it is. I'll tell you, the second one I would be Jody Hamilton. The matches I had with him, he was just so smooth. You know, what really got that match over with him and Augusta is...
I refereed that.
Beg your pardon?
I refereed it.
I got on TV in Atlanta with Tom Ernesto's idea to put this, jump up in a guy's back, take my knuckle, and put it into the guy's back of the neck. And, of course, Shekino, he's Japanese. It was a Japanese move, and it beat him. And I'm now going to wrestle the assassin. in Augusta. I think in 2 or 3 weeks, Jody was going to Japan. So I pulled his mask off in Augusta. And then I got on TV and I says, you know, what did it was this knuckle. And what I'm going to do next week is I'm going to be in the audience, in the lobby, sitting with the promoter. And I want the people to come in and give me that middle finger, and I'll put that little tape around it. When you think I need to use that knuckle, you raise those knuckles up in the audience, and I'll be able to fight for you. Well, I was in a lobby the next week. They lined up. Someone came up with a baby. I had to put the tape around the baby's middle finger. And the mother had it, and the father had it, and all the kids, and I had it sitting around ringside. So it's an hour match. Jody's got me in a. I'm sitting down, and he's got his left arm around my neck, and he's got on. He's on his left knee and his right foot, and he's got me hooked. And I got my knuckle up, and I start raising my knuckle up with the tape on it. I look out there, and those people forgot that I said knuckle, and they got this middle finger stuck up in the air with this tape around it.
I think Charlie was in that. I think that was geared towards Charlie. I was
going to
say, Charlie used to get the middle finger all the time.
But yeah. I told Jody, that's what those fans think of you.
But Dickie didn't tell, between Columbus and Augusta that day, we bought every roll of tape on the way to Augusta we could find.
All right, Bobby, how about you?
Well, from a referee standpoint, the best matches I ever refereed was Funk against Briscoe. I probably did 12, 13 of those, and those were the best as far as being a referee. All I had to do was stay out of the way.
You know, that's unusual because Briscoe was left-handed. Think about it. I mean, that's a crown in his feather, you know.
Yeah. Those were. I mean, those guys worked together so much. They didn't even call spots. They just did stuff. It was amazing to me. The worst as a referee, always the new guys were the worst guys to referee because they're the guys that wanted to point at the lady in the front row and wanted you to look out there while they got the cheap heat, and when you wouldn't do it, they'd get hot at you and that sort of stuff. There was a bunch of those. But the few times that I wrestled over the years, the worst I ever was Jerry's protege, Otis Sistrunk.
Yeah. Oh,
God. I fought for my life.
I had no idea you wrestled Otis.
Oh, jeez. I ran is what I did. His big deal was that clothesline. And I told him, I said, if you swing that arm at me, I said, I'll duck. I said, you just hold it out there. I'll take care of the rest of it. But I also said this, and he's on the phone, and I'm not blowing smoke, but this is the gospel truth as best I can tell it. Dick Steinmore is the best babyface I was ever in the ring with.
Well, bless your heart.
Because he knew how to sell, and he could get sympathy, and that was, that's a lost art. But I know it's, and here again, it's on YouTube. It's out there. You can find it. There's a 15-minute Broadway match that you can find with him and Tommy Siegler, and that's one of the best matches I've ever seen.
You know, I'll tell you something. After 7 years of being a pro, I started at age 17, 21, 22 years of age, the business had changed so much that it went into the power of television. The television was so powerful that the promoters started creating their own stars. It used to be with the National Wrestling Alliance before TV, they would exchange students, exchange wrestlers, exchange bookers, blackball somebody. So now when that was investigated by the FBI and they broke that up, there was no more monopoly. Now each independent promoter wanted to make their own champions. They had state champions, they had United States champions, they had world champions, regional champions, Middle American champions. And at 7 or 8 years of age, I saw all of this, and whose butt am I going to have to kiss? What territory do I have to go to kiss somebody's butt because, how good I am? I didn't want to do that. So I started watching all the matches, and when I see something that got over, I added it to it. I added something with that. Would it be something? And if you did it another minute later and then use it as an ending,
man, and then you put it in your storage bin up in your brain. And after a while, I said to myself, the best way for me to get along and make money and get as high as I can in this business is to have the best match on the card. And when I went out there with a jabroni who couldn't work and I had to go 15 minutes, it was an exciting 15 minutes. Whatever I did or whatever I had to do was slow down. Even my mark of a brother, Henry, I went in Orlando with Chick Garibaldi, and that's one of the guys you had to adjust to. So 2 weeks before, I had a great match in Orlando. Last week, a great match in Orlando. I get in the ring with Chick Garibaldi. I had to adjust. And the match wasn't that good. And I come in the dressing room. My brother said, why didn't you go out there and snatch him and pull him this way? And I looked at him and I thought to myself, he's a mark. My brother doesn't know anything about this business. So if you can get along with every one of the wrestlers, well, pretty soon, promoters, if they see you on the first match, or the second match in the territory, and you have an outstanding match with somebody that nobody can have a match with, you're in the semifinal next week. If I was a promoter, that's what I would do. And that's what usually would happen.
Did you wrestle Rogers much?
Gosh, yes.
What was your opinion of him?
Let me tell you what I did there. I almost did a double cross on Buddy Rogers. He was my idol. He taught Donnie Fargo how to work. And Donnie taught me. I said, this is what he does? Yeah, sequence. They nicknamed it sequence. They even had a big 20-page deal by Jacobs on sequence. We call them high spots, or go back in the same mood, or go back to the same hold again, and so forth. And he came to Florida, and I was going to wrestle him in West Palm Beach. And it was a small dressing room. At that particular time, he came down there with Joe Louis. He had Joe Louis on the contract. Joe Louis now wrestling. We're going to West Palm Beach. That place is packed. And Joe Louis is on the card, and there's a big disturbance about Black being on there. The dressing room is filled up with press, and it's a small dressing room. I'm talking about 3-4 guys. They had to move around. And I'm wrestling with him, and he looks into the mirror, and he looks back at me. He says, Ricky, did you ever work with Don Colt? I says, yeah. He says, same thing tonight. That's all he said. Man, I never looked as good in the ring as I looked that night. Unfortunately, I slept on the banana peel, and I lost. And that was Buddy Rogers. So I worked with him there. I worked with him in Charlotte. I had great matches with him in Charlotte. And now I go up to New York, and they're pushing me. And Vince McMahon Sr. had me up in Bridgeport. And Bridgeport was sending the live telecast into Chicago. And I was over. And I was getting over and over. And they were building Buddy Rogers to wrestle O'Connor for the title. And the week before, he wrestled me. And the week before me, he wrestled Big Bill Miller. And week before them, I think he wrestled Gotch. And they were all one-fall matches. So Gotch, one-fall match, next show, month later, building for who's going to wrestle O'Connor is Rogers against Big Bill Miller in a one-fall match. And they come up with a two-out-of-three-fall match with me and Buddy, and he's going to go in the ring with O'Connor in a two-fall-three-fall match. In my little brain, I'm saying to myself, I need to win the first fall. Because if it was a one-fall match, I'd be champion. But unfortunately, it's a two-out-of-three-fall match. So that was the psychology of my brain. So I'm in Chicago's Coliseum, whatever it was, the old wooden building. And Fred Kohler comes in. He says, let's go upstairs. We go way up in the loft. I mean, way up there in the dark. Buddy, me, and Fred. And would you mind? I said, not at all. And I said, I'd like to take the first fall. Oh, no, what are you talking about? Oh, what the hell, you just built. And Buddy said, no, we can't do that. I said, all right. So we went in the ring. And he controlled it. And when he says, come back. So I started coming back. And he's still getting, you know, fighting. But I'm coming back, but I'm missing the punch and falling him up. And I keep falling. I keep fighting. And I'm not making the comeback. And he wanted me to. And he's keep doing this, and all of a sudden, when I did make the deal, and it was like 20 seconds longer than it should have been, or a minute longer than it should have been, I blew up. It was drop kicks and all over the place, and I put this ridiculous Texas octopus on him. You hook the right leg between the left one, put the left one over his head, grab his right arm, and you bend him over, and you put him in with Ray Gunkel. So, and when I put it on him, he says, "Take it, Daddy." First fall. Gave me the first fall. It was a feather in my cap. The people went crazy. And I swear to you, a couple of them got up and started walking. They thought it was a one-fall match. But anyway, next show he was with O'Connor. And that O'Connor, if you ever watched, have you got that tape? Did I ask you about that once before? The O'Connor tape?
Yeah, I've got the title switch, yeah.
If you'll see,
I don't have the whole card. I wish I did.
He's got Buddy down, and Buddy's facing the camera. I'm upstairs in the control booth with an 8 millimeter movie camera filming it. When they got through with the match, they zoomed in and got the announcer and myself, but they cut those off, those tapes now. But I'm filming it, and when O'Connor came to Florida a couple of years later, he says, "You got the film?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Take a good look at it." He said, "When Buddy's sitting there," he says, "I take my finger and I run it around this inside of his mouth about 2-3 times." He takes his right finger, and he's sitting behind him, right, with his arm around his neck, and he goes into his mouth, and he curls like he's trying to take popcorn out of his mouth. 3 times. And then while we're in the car driving to Tampa, he says, "I want you to see the end of that film." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because," he says, "I wanted to have a controversy." I said, "What's that?" He said, "I drop kicked," he says, "and I missed." Buddy stepped aside. He straddled the rope. He fell back holding his groin. Buddy was supposed to cover him, but Pat rolled. And you can see Buddy, he's almost falling, trying to follow him, because O'Connor keep moving. And when O'Connor got to the ropes, he pushed his leg up, and he was going to touch his toe on the top rope. That's what he told me in the car. I said, "I'll go home and look at the film." A couple of days later, I looked at the film. He missed it. Saw him again. I said, "Pat," I says, "your foot didn't touch the top rope." He looked dejected. I mean, he really looked sad. He thought maybe he touched the rope and he could use it as a return or whatever. But Buddy was one of the best. Great, 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 great performer. In fact, Thez came to Richmond, Virginia some years ago before he passed away. He was living over in Norfolk. And I met him at the Thomas Jefferson Hotel here, and we sat and talked for a while. And I talked about Buddy, and he didn't like him. All he said was, great performer. He didn't get along with him.
Well, I'm going to ask you, would know. How tough was this?
Ooh. First of all, he was left-handed. What can I tell you? I mean, he wrist locked you before you knew it.
Yeah, I know.
He had that thing, and if he wanted to rip your arm out, you better go with him. He said, I used to protect the guys by taking my left foot and put it in the groin. He said, when I took them over, he said, I flipped their whole body over. He said, some of these guys were stupid enough not to go over. But he was tough.
I know the first time I ever wrestled him was on Atlanta TV, and I forgot who it was. They said, if he goes for that double wrist lock, you better be ready. And I'm telling you, man, God, I was nervous wreck.
In Savannah, Georgia, at the Civic Center down there, Jack was working with Thez right after Jack had won the title, and Rockets sat in the dressing room, and Rockets ribbing him up about going for, he said, "Jack, I think you ought to go for a double wrist lock." and Briscoe goes, "Yeah," he said, "I think I will go for it tonight." So they went out and they had their match, and when they come back, when Jack gets back in the dressing room, he is skint from the top of his head right down the middle of his bridge of his nose. Rocket asked him, he said, "Jack," he said, "what about that double wrist lock?" All Jack said was, "I missed it."
I see this one time in Orlando, the sports stadium, they had in the dressing room, there was a hole cut in the brick wall. You could talk to somebody. So Malenko was standing there, and Thez was talking to him. He says, "I just came back from South America." He says, if I'm resting on you, he says, "if you find me resting on your back, I'm just taking a rest." He signed me, "find you behind you, laying on you." He said, "I'm just taking a rest." He was kidding him. I told him about the first time I worked with him. Did I tell you that story?
No.
Sure. I told
you. You probably told me years ago.
was in the business 17 years. I'm in Texas. Leo Garibaldi's promoting Austin, Texas. He brings in Thez, and he got him booked against me. I'm driving up. I'm in the, sitting in the back seat of Ramon Torres and Al Torres Cadillac. Ramon says, "Who are you working with?" I said, "Gentlemen, I've been in the business 17 years. I've known Lou Thez since I was 5 or 6 years of age. He knew my mother. He's been to my house, and he knows me, and blah, blah, blah." And I told some stories. When he first came to my dad's house when I was 15 years of age, I says, as he walked in the living room, my dad says, "Go behind him." So I went to shake his hand. I went to pull him, and he had me up in the air. And he laughed and so forth. Ramon says, "Hey, you know what Lou likes?" I said, "What's that?" "He liked to be slapped." "Oh, really? Well, hell, I'll slap the crap out of him." So I see Ramon punch his brother Al, and Al says, "Yeah," he says, "Yo, we'll watch it." I say, "Sure, I will, sure." So before I tell you the rest of the story, years ago, Bobby Becker taught me how to slap somebody. He said, "You cup your hand," and he says, "You stand back," and he says, "You practice by hitting that turnbuckle." And he says, you can just place it perfect. And as long as you got the eye on it, you can place it. And he says, you cup it, and he says, you don't hit the jaw. You hit underneath the jaw, underneath the ear, and it pops. And if you drag it down, you do it quick. Pow! Before they knew it, you've done it. So Marvin Jones is the referee. I'm in the ring. And just before I go in the ring, Ramon comes over and he taps me on the knees. "Don't forget to slap him now." I said, "All right." So I look back. All the dressing was out. They were all watching the matches. So Leo comes in the ring and he announces the match. The match starts. And if I watch Lou work a lot of times, if you come out firing like a bullet, he'll back up. And he'll go underneath that top turnbuckle, or the top rope, right, and he'll put his left leg up and bring it up there. And I just had that perfect position. I came across that ring. I was ready for him. He ducked underneath. Marvin Jones stands in front of me, and he used to talk with a step back. So I stepped back, and Lou comes back out. We walked around a little bit, and I looked at the crowd, and I got him up, and I chased him again. He ducks underneath that thing again. Marvin gets in front of me, and as Marvin moves, I move Marvin to the side, and as Lou comes down, I came across with that slap, and I hit him across that neck. You heard a pop. And he looked at me, and I swear to God, his leg was up, still up in the air. And what made him laugh, I swear to God, I said, "Look, Marvin, he's got goose pimples on his leg." And they were. They were like chicken legs or something up on his thigh. Well, he snatched me. Oh, no, I'm sorry. He walks around, and I see him talking to Marvin Jones. And he's saying something to him, whispering to him. And we hook up, and all of a sudden he says, "Body scissor." So I get a body scissor, and he goes up, and he goes down, and he goes up and down, and don't ever get a body scissor. Let him get a body while he's passing out. Don't let him get a body scissor on you, because he has a way of turning around and flipping you over, and before you know it, you're on your knees, or on your stomach, rather, and your left leg is caught, and you've got you hooked. And you're hooked there. Nothing you can do. And Marvin Jones gets down in front of me, and he says, "Hey, Nicky, are you gay?" I said, "What?" Lou says, "Answer him." I said, "What are you talking about?" And I feel the pressure hit my knee. I said, "Oh, jeez. Oh, God." Marvin says, "I ask you again, are you gay?" And I says, "No." Lou says, "Answer him." I said, "Yes." And I screamed. He grabbed my mouth and rolled me over. The match was over. I go back in the dressing room. And I says to Ramon, "Hey, I slapped the crap out of him, huh? I told you I would." "Oh, what the heck? Nothing to it."
Shoot. Well, guys, we got about 15 minutes left, and I want to get to our name of the week. But before I do that, I just want to mention some illnesses that have been going on. Don Wright had a stroke last week, a week before, but he got to the hospital before it was serious. They were able to put a stent in and stave it off, and he's home and doing well. Been a bad week for Don's. Don Kernodle had quadruple bypass.
No.
He had that Tuesday. But he's doing fine. He's still in CCU, the last I heard, but he is doing fine. And Don Green is in hospital in Nashville with congestive heart failure.
So
you guys keep those guys in our thoughts and prayers. And the guy I'm gonna put on the line here in a minute, a friend of ours, Greg Brown, who was in the hospital last week when we talked to him. Let me get him on the line here real quick. Greg, you with us?
Hello.
How you doing, Greg?
Doing good. A lot better than I was.
They finally run you out of the hospital?
They ran me out Saturday evening.
Good.
That's good.
Yeah, good. But I'm doing good, guys. I really am. Thanks for reaching out.
Not a problem. I know you've been in my thoughts and prayers for the last week, so I'm glad you're doing well.
Well, I appreciate it.
But anyway, this is our time for our name of the week, and I think what I do is I pick a name from the past. Hopefully it's somebody that Bobby and Jerry and whoever else is with us remembers can tell some stories on. And this week, our name of the week, which is sponsored by Jerry Oates Natural Products, by the way, is El Gaucho, Juan Sebastian.
Married to her name is Bell.
Bell Star, yeah.
Right.
I was never really around him.
I wrestled him in Daytona Beach once, I think. Yes. That's all I can tell you about him.
Yeah, I saw him wrestle a lot of times when I was a kid going to matches, but I never met him that I know of.
You know, he did a lot of different gimmicks. He and Pedro Godoy were one version of the medics about the same time that Tony Gonzalez and Don Lordy were doing the medics in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Godoy and Sebastian were the medics in Detroit. They also worked in the early 70s in New York for Vince Sr. as the Russians, the masked Russians, and they had Nikita Malkovich as their manager. In between that, he and Tarzan Baxter were the Gauchos, both masked and unmasked.
I remember
they
that.
Worked as the Gauchos.
Yeah, I remember that time.
And then the last I know of Juan working, well, he homesteaded, I guess, down in Florida towards the end of his career and just worked periodically. But he was in here in Mobile in 73 as under the mask as the Rugged Russian. And I was real impressed with him. I thought he was a great wrestler. I would love to have seen him in his prime. But
a nice body, too.
Yeah, he was a well-built guy. But... Well, I hate I picked one you guys.
Yeah, I was fixing to say the name of the week just kind of died there this week.
Well, it was a toss-up between him. We'll do a second one. It was going to be a toss-up between him and Johnny Ringo, but I figured you guys would know more about him than you would Johnny Ringo.
Well, if it's the Johnny Ringo that worked with Ann Gunkle, personal-wise, I didn't know him real well, but I refereed a lot of his matches.
Well, this guy worked up in Charlotte. He came through here for a little bit. He was down in Florida.
He wasn't a very big guy, was he?
No.
That's the Ringo I know, if that's the same one you're talking about.
Wasn't he, Michael, was he from Philadelphia or somewhere?
What's that?
Was he from Philadelphia?
I want to say he was from somewhere in Virginia, but I don't know for sure.
Okay. I'm pretty sure it's the same guy.
I'm sure it was.
That's surprising to hear about Don Canoodle. My goodness. Wasn't he involved with the racetrack or something? Wasn't he involved with
I'm not sure.
Charlotte Raceway. He was working publicity, he and his brother or something. But that's unusual to hear, Wes. He had a lot of potential. Another guy was Rip Smith. In Knoxville. What a great amateur he was. He had a great potential. These guys just got out in and out of the business.
Yeah, actually, he was called Urban Smith then, but he worked around a lot in Georgia. I think you worked with him some, Jerry.
Urban Smith?
76 or so. Urban Smith, yeah.
No, this is...
He worked as Rip Smith in Knoxville.
That's it, yes. Whatever happened to him?
Well, he wasn't... I don't know. But, he was a good worker from what I remember seeing about him.
Yeah, because when you got that amateur background and he was athletically inclined, And I worked with him a few times. He just was smooth, you know, underrated. So you talked about the worst wrestler. The worst wrestler was, somebody mentioned, was Ox Baker.
Yeah, I'm surprised none of you guys pulled his name.
Well, you know, I knew something. He had such heavy, thick bones. I picked him up one time to do a slam, and I felt, you know, of course, I fell backwards on purpose. When I fell, I swear, I felt like I had a sack full of bricks. I got a punch in my chest and a punch in my ribs and a punch in my shoulder. I swear it was just bones. You know, when somebody else falls on you, and you, this was a sack of bones. It felt like bricks.
He hit me harder than any human being has ever hit me in my life. He went to hit me with, I was refereeing, and I forget what the deal was, but he went to hit me with that elbow in the top of the head. We were in Columbus, Georgia, and he did the deal. He looked out the front row at some lady on the front row, and he goes, "Hey, baby, this is for you," and forgot what he was doing. And he hit me so hard that I thought he drove my head right out through my rear end, and I didn't even take a bump. I just stood there and looked at him. I've
you
never been hit that hard.
Buddy.
Oh, jeez.
Of course, my career was nowhere near the legendary career you guys had, but the worst guy I ever worked with, and I don't know his name, I can tell you where it was. It was in a little town called Fayette, Alabama. And I was working heel, and this guy was a local, and I go out there, and at that time, I'm 6'5", and at that time I weighed about 220, 225, but everybody in all these little podunk towns that I was working at, these little outlaw programs, you know, the guys were 140, 150, 160 pounds. Well, then I go out there, and this guy's the same way. He's about 5'7", maybe 165 pounds. I wasn't really paying any attention to him when I got in the ring, but I kind of looked him over a little bit. But when they called us to the middle of the ring to do the referee's instruction, I looked at this guy and I knew I was in trouble. He had on the bodysuit, you know, a green and white bodysuit. It was the white leggings, white tank top, green trunks, with green stripes piping down but they were all one piece.
Did he have any tattoos?
See the stitching. No, but I could see the stitching. Come to find out, his mother made the outfit for him. So backyard wrestling didn't start just recently. They had backyard wrestling in Alabama in the late 70s, early 80s. But that guy, every time, of course, I was working heel, and he was a local hero, so, you know, he was calling the matches, because I never did get to where I could call a match, because I worked so sporadically. But he had one spot that he loved, where he grabbed me in a side headlock and take me over. Well, every time he did, before I got to the mat, he would slip and he would fall on me. He bruised my ribs, and there was a guy, the referee, had to look like Haystacks Calhoun. He stepped on my finger. I was lucky to get out of that night with my life and my $15 I made.
Hey, Dick.
But the best I ever worked with, but I know Dick's worked with him, and that was Ken Lucas.
Oh, yeah.
And Ken Lucas, because he was, you know, a hero of mine growing up, and I wrestled him in Pensacola, which was my hometown, and it was just a thrill for me. But the thing about Ken Lucas is he talked so fast.
Yeah.
And of course, he's calling the match. It was hard. I was just lucky to catch what it was he was saying, and the match turned out okay. But he was fun to work with.
Hey, Dick, I know we hadn't got much time, but I was telling the guys this last week, and I told them next time we got you on, I wanted you to tell it. Tell the story about imitating Barnett and calling Ox in Puerto Rico.
Oh. Well, first of all, I couldn't remember a couple of weeks ago what Barnett looked like, but if you remember the movie director, Woody Allen, he looked just like Woody Allen, and he talked like Truman Capote. Judy Capote is the one who wrote In Cold Blood. And I heard Truman Capote talk one time, and he sounded like Barnett. So I started imitating. It became easy, because Truman Capote would say, "When I wrote In Cold Blood, it was one of the best movies I've ever made. And that's the way Barnett talked. So I get down, I was working in Puerto Rico for Carlos Colon, and Barnett is out of the Atlanta office, and he's going to run opposition to Carlos Colon in Puerto Rico. So they're in Caguas, which is 15 miles, no, I'm sorry. They're in Bayamon Stadium, and we're in another part of the, we're in Caguas, that's what it was. So Ox has checked into the hotel, and ironically enough, the boys from the NWA, Mike Graham and that whole crew, they checked in the same hotel too, which was unusual, you know. So they made a mistake and put them, all of us in the same hotel. So we're waiting, as Tom and Esther, myself, Don Serrano, we're waiting to go catch a car to go to Caguas. In the meantime, Ox comes and sees me, and he says, guess what happened? I said, what? He said, I got on the airplane. He said, with Barnett. I said, really? He said, yeah.
He said, he's in first class.
And Junior's up there. It was Junior and Briscoe. That was the main event for the NWA. And I said, well, what happened? He says, well, Briscoe comes back in the second class and says, Barnett wants to see you. So I go up there and I sit with him. I said this the way wrong. Barnett is sitting in first class, and Ox is sitting in first class, and Briscoe's in second class. So Ox tells me, he said, Barnett looks over at him in first class and says, Ox, would you mind going in the back and telling Briscoe I want to see him? And Ox says,
what are you talking about?
And he says, he reached over the aisle and handed me $100. Ox says, I got up, went in the back, and told Briscoe, and he went up and took my place, and he sat with him, got some guy to move over. He said, I let him talk for about 45 minutes. He says, and I went back up and got through the curtains, and he stood over the seat and looked at him, and he says, Barnett looked at him, and he looked at him, reached in his pocket, got another 100 and handed it to him, and he said, I went back in the second class. I said, you're kidding. He said, no. Now, we're all in the same hotel. So, it's time to go to the matches. So, somebody said, go call Ox. So, I go over to the phone, and there's all the NW guys in the lobby. And I go over to the phone, and I call Ox's room. And I did not plan this, I swear to God. It just came out natural.
He said, hello.
I said, Ox, this is Jim Barnett.
Yes, Jim.
I says, I want you to... I says, can you have a meeting with me tonight after the matches? And he says, what time? I said, where are you working? He said, Congress. I says, well, I'll see you back at the hotel here. He said, no, women are. I says, I had to check out of this hotel and go over to the San Juan, because he told me the same thing. The water wasn't running or something in this hotel, and he had to go to the San Juan. I'm at the San Juan. I'll call you later on. And Barnett always had this thing to say on the phone when he talked to one of the boys. Ox says, okay, I'll wait for your call. And I says, Ox, do me one favor. And he says, what? I said, don't tell any of the boys.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I tell Tom Modesto. I tell Serrano. And who else was in the car with us? And the limousine pulls up. Serrano's driving. I'm sitting in the back on the left-hand side. Ox is in the middle, and he's got this big left shoulder against my face, practically. And he's leaning toward Tom. There's three of us in the back seat, Tom Modesto. So I had told Tom already. Now we're driving to Caguas. So Tom says, who'd you fly over with?
Ox says.
He looks at him. He said, Barnett was on the plane. He says, he was. He says, yeah. He says, did you talk to him lately? After the match? I mean, after the flight in? And he looks at him. And I didn't want him to get in trouble. And from the little low voice on the lower left-hand corner of this car, I said out loud, and do me one favor, don't tell any of the boys. And he turned around and looked at me. And Tom told me later on what you should have done was, he says, we would have figured that out. He says, we would have told him that Barnett was going to give him $500 or $600 if he'd run back to the Bayamon Stadium and run in the ring with Briscoe and Bone.
What a way to end the show, guys. We are out of time. And Dick, I appreciate you joining us. Charlie, Greg, appreciate you guys calling in. Dick, we're going to have you on again, man. This is just too fun.
Just fun.
Good enough. Enjoy talking to you guys.
All right.
Y'all take care.
All right,
thanks for calling, man.
All right.
Bye.
Good night, guys. We will get together next Thursday, and we will do this again.
Sounds good.
It was a good one,
right.
Guys.
Take care, guys.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Guys.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.